Hello, it's Tuesday, March the 3rd. I'm Belinda Rhodes. In today's programme, Gordon Brown meets Barack Obama in Washington today. Are they set to become best buddies?
The main agenda for everybody at the moment is saving the world economy from a recession sliding into a depression. Fortunately, Mr. Brown and Mr. Obama seem to think roughly the same way about this.
It's no time to be eating expensive food, says Moscow, as it issues dietary advice for Russians as the economic downturn bites.
It's pretty bland fare. It's things like oat porridge for breakfast, cabbage and cauliflower salad, a lot of fish.
And why Taliban leader Mullah Omar is calling on Pakistani jihadists to come and join the struggle in Afghanistan.
It seems that these new Pakistani Taliban will be reorientated in time for the spring offensive this year. So, you know, it could have an impact.
But first, let's have the news headlines and a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
Six members of the Sri Lanka cricket squad have been wounded when around a dozen gunmen attacked their bus as it drove under police escort to a stadium in the Pakistani city of Lahore. The Lahore police chief said five people were killed in the attack by the unidentified gunmen who fired AK-47s and rockets and hurled grenades as the team bus drove to the stadium in the eastern part of the city. Pakistan television has been showing footage of gunmen with rifles and backpacks running through the streets and firing on unidentified vehicles. Five players and an assistant coach were reported to be wounded, with two being treated in hospital. Sri Lanka has immediately cancelled the rest of the tour. The Prime Minister Gordon Brown is in Washington to meet President Barack Obama to discuss the economic crisis. Mr. Brown becomes the first European leader to visit the new US president, and he hopes to benefit from the two countries' so-called special relationship. The Prime Minister, who arrived on Monday night, is laying the groundwork for the G20 Economic Summit of Advanced and Developing Nations in London next month, which he'll chair. The summit is critical for improving global economic confidence as well as Brown's political prospects. Brown plans to deliver a tough economic message for the White House and US lawmakers, whom he'll address on Wednesday. He's urging the United States to avoid protectionism at a time when it has populist appeal. Meanwhile, Japanese stocks recovered somewhat after dipping below its lowest close in 26 years in early trading. The drop came as bank shares responded to the record losses of the US insurance company AIG, which, at almost £62 billion, is the largest quarterly loss in corporate history. The Dow Jones fell below 7,000 points yesterday for the first time since 1997. Now to Cuba, where the president, Raul Castro, removed some of Cuba's most powerful officials in the biggest government shake-up since he took over from his ailing brother Fidel Castro a year ago. The changes replaced some key Fidel loyalists, including the longtime foreign minister and the secretary of the Council of State. They also reduced the enormous powers of a vice president credited with saving Cuba's economy after the fall of the Soviet Union. The most prominent of those who were removed was the foreign minister, Felipe Perez Roque. He was the youngest of Cuba's top leaders and had been widely mentioned as a possible future president. He was replaced by his own deputy, Bruno Rodriguez, who once served as Cuba's ambassador to the United Nations. Now, look at the headlines. The Corpus Christi student who became the darling of University Challenge after propelling her team to victory by answering two-thirds of their questions, Gail Trimble, features on the fronts of many papers today as the BBC stripped her team of its title. One of the Corpus Christi members, Sam Kay, had already finished university before the end of the taping of the quiz show. He'd begun work as an accountant by the time of the final. In the Telegraph, the Chancellor, Alistair Darling, admits the government made mistakes on the economy. In an interview with the broadsheet, Mr. Darling says there are a lot of lessons to be learned from the events that led to the economic downturn. Under the headline Betrayal of the Foster Parents, the Daily Mail features the story of a couple who took in a homeless teenager. They say social workers didn't tell them about the teenager's history of alleged sex attacks, and as a result, he raped their two-year-old son and molested their nine-year-old daughter. The Independent says the Science Museum in London is accused by more than 400 academics of promoting Israeli universities whose research was used in the country's military campaign in Gaza. Wall Street's biggest drop since 1997 features on the front of the Financial Times. The Times carries a photograph of the 200 whales and dolphins that became stranded on an Australian beach at the weekend. Conservationists there are demanding an inquiry into what they feel is a suspicious stranding of the sea mammals. The Sun and the Daily Mirror feature pictures of Jade Goody before heading into emergency surgery. Miss Goody, who's suffering from terminal cancer, was having an operation to remove a blockage from her bowels. And those are the headlines today. More news updated through the day on guardian.co.uk.
Gordon Brown has arrived in Washington, D.C., and will today become the first European leader to meet the new U.S. President Barack Obama. The two men met last year while Mr. Obama was still campaigning for the presidency, and now, 1 month into his term of office, they meet again. The decision to invite the British Prime Minister before the French or German leaders is seen as an indication of the value to America of the so-called special relationship between Britain and the U.S. But in these times of economic mayhem, Mr. Brown and Mr. Obama have more pressing things on their minds than becoming good buddies. I asked our senior political commentator, Michael White, what's on the agenda.
The main agenda for everybody at the moment is saving the world economy from a recession sliding into a depression. Fortunately, Mr. Brown and Mr. Obama seem to think roughly the same way about this, that you've got to pump a lot of money into the system and pay for it all later. So they have broad agreement, but no doubt there'll be differences of detail. And of course, the US always looks after number one, and Britain is a bit worried about Buy America sentiments, which are quite strong still in the new administration.
And in terms of the impact of this visit on the Prime Minister himself, what do you think will be, do you expect him to get some kind of reflected charisma from being the first European leader to visit President Obama?
Well, I've been reading up these last few days about relationships between presidents and prime ministers. You can never tell. Tony Blair was famously friendly with Bill Clinton and managed to be friendly with George Bush too. Harry Truman and Clem Attlee, the Labour Prime Minister in the 40s, got on very well, but they didn't visit each other much in those days. Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, very personal. So what we can tell about Mr. Obama, he's keen to focus on the wider world and not fall back on this particular cozy relationship with Europe first and with Britain in particular, the famous special relationship. He's not a sort of sentimental Anglophile. I think everybody agrees with that. On the other hand, we've always been a pretty reliable ally, and they've certainly put the red carpet out for Gordon Brown. He's been invited to address both houses of Congress. That doesn't happen for many people. So it's a big opportunity, as you put it, for Brown to get a bit of reflected glory from Mr. Obama, provided he uses it right.
And do you think he can?
Well, he's got to avoid lecturing the Americans, and he's got to make a lively Gordon Brown speech rather than a dull Gordon Brown speech, and he mustn't tread on any toes. What I think he probably wants to do is play to his strength. He really does understand the economic issues. He doesn't get them all right, mind you. He didn't as Chancellor, and he doesn't now. Lord knows it's hard enough to make the right choices with the banking system collapsing. But, you know, he talks the talk. And he's a technocrat and a details man, and we know that Obama's that way inclined too. And they both believe, as do the Democrats who now control both houses of Congress, they both believe in an active government. They're not small state people like Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and George Bush, of course. So there ought to be, you know, there ought to be a big love-in between all these people. They all agree the same thing. But mood music is also important, and GB's not so good at chat and sunshine and mood music in the way that Tony Blair effortlessly found himself able to do. Made himself very popular in America, Blair. Still is popular despite everything.
But perhaps this more international approach that you mentioned from Obama, relying a little bit less on the so-called special relationship, perhaps that's something that will appeal to Mr. Brown.
In theory, it appeals to European leaders. And of course, it's not just about economics here. The world is changing very fast. The economic crisis is making it change faster. And there are sensitive subjects to Europeans. For example, the Security Council, 5 permanent members, each with their veto. They include Britain and France. And many people say the European Union ought to give up one of those 2 seats, have one voice between it, and give that seat to, let's say, India. That's the great emerging economy of Asia, which doesn't have a seat. And the same goes for the voting rights of the International Monetary Fund. Gordon Brown wants that modernized and expanded. And the same goes for the World Bank, set up in 1944 as well. He wants that modernized and expanded. But as soon as you say, hey, you Europeans, hey, you Brits, in order to bring in the Brazilians and the Indians and other emerging economies, we need you to give a little, then it gets tricky for both sides. So plenty of broad agreement, plenty of fighting in the detail.
And just briefly, Michael, do you think there are any risks to Mr. Brown while he's gone? Is there anyone back in London who wants to take advantage of his absence in any way?
Well, you make it sound as if Harriet Harman's about to stage a military coup with tanks on the corner of Parliament Square. I don't think that's quite her style, do you? No, Brown's cabinet, whatever doubts they have about the Prime Minister, are united behind him now. Nobody else could do the job at the moment. Nobody has the expertise, and most of that kind of chat's in the media. David Cameron, of course, has problems of his own with the Americans, partly inherited by Michael Howard, who mucked about on the Iraq War and annoyed the Bush White House. Pretty tricky thing for Howard to do, considering he's such a pro-American, but he managed it. And Cameron, of course, and Osborne are the odd ones out in terms of international reflating the economies, pumping huge quantities of money in. They've stood against that, and even under Mr. Bush, they were a bit isolated, and under Mr. Obama, they're very isolated.
Michael White there. And as Michael mentioned, Tony Blair is still very popular amongst Americans. But as Ed Pilkington found out on the streets of Manhattan, very few of them seem to know who Gordon Brown is.
I'm standing just off Broadway in Manhattan, a few hours before Gordon Brown arrives in Washington at the start of his two-day visit to Barack Obama and Congress. The snow's coming down here. There's been a blizzard overnight and about 6 inches of snow has settled here, so people have quite a bit on their minds, a bit more than the arrival of the British Prime Minister. But nevertheless, I'm going to disturb a few of them and ask them what they think about his arrival.
My name's Bill Schultz. I work at Stylecaster.com. I'm production officer there.
And you're going to tell me whether, my fingers are frozen,
whether you recognise him.
No, I don't.
You don't. If I say that my accent is a clue, does that make you think of anything?
British, but I don't know. I still don't know who it is.
Okay, and if I say he's our Prime Minister, Gordon Brown.
Okay, I'll take your word for that.
Okay, so he's meeting Barack Obama in Washington tomorrow. He's coming tonight. Does that make you think of anything, that the British leader and your president getting together?
It's an important first step. You know, the United States needs to improve its relations with the rest of the world. It's been lacking in the last couple of years greatly. So.
And Britain's a reasonable place to start?
Absolutely.
Yes, my name is Michael Hull, and I'm a building maintenance supervisor.
Great. So, Michael, I'm going to show you a picture, oopsie, which I just dropped, into the snow of Broadway. And Michael's very kindly picking it up for me. Now, he's opened it up. Now, Michael, who is this man?
He's some type of elected official. I don't know his name, but...
How do you know that?
I've seen him before on television.
Okay. Can you tell me anything more? Like, do you know which country he comes from? I'll give you a clue. My accent is a clue.
England.
Good man. And that's all you know?
That's all I can
say. So what would you say if I said to you, this is Gordon Brown, he's the Prime Minister of England, and he's coming to Washington to meet Barack Obama tonight?
That's a great thing.
Yeah, my name is Samuel, Sam. I sell T-shirts over here, T-shirts, men clothes, men and women kids clothes.
And I see you're selling a lot of Barack Obama T-shirts.
Yeah, it's because he's the man.
They very popular?
Well, really, really popular. You know, he's God-gifted to the whole world.
Okay, now I'm going to show you a picture of another man. Here it is. Do you recognize this man?
Well, the picture is not too familiar. No, I don't really recognize him.
My name is Teresa McGinn. I'm an associate professor at Columbia.
Very good. In which subject?
Public health.
Okay. Well, I wondered if you could tell me who it is.
You know, I don't know. It's not Gordon Brown. It's a UK leader, no? Some politician from UK, but I don't know who.
And it's not Gordon Brown because...
He's younger. Is that Gordon Brown? It is. He looks... sorry.
No, don't worry.
He looks tired.
That's a pretty perceptive comment.
He looks much older than I normally... He looks older and kind of more haggard than I normally think of him.
What's your name?
William.
Okay, William, I'm going to show you something. William, what does that make you think? Who is that?
I actually don't know who that is.
Okay. As luck would have it, William is standing beside a Briton. Are you two friends?
Yes.
You work together?
Kind of.
What's your name?
Michael.
Okay, Michael, you're a Briton, and I presume you know who that is.
I do know who that is.
Who is
it? It's Gordon Brown.
Ah, it's a picture of Gordon Brown. So, William, do you know who Gordon Brown is?
No, I don't.
You don't even know who Gordon Brown is? Not a single clue?
No.
Some views from New York. And of course, you can read all about Mr. Brown's visit to Washington on our website, including a live blog from Oliver Berkman. And also on The Guardian's website today, in a diary from Afghanistan, diplomatic editor Julian Borger asks what the future holds for the country as it prepares for elections. That's at guardian.co.uk/Afghanistan. From 7:30 p.m. at guardian.co.uk/football, you'll be able to follow Liverpool's bid to keep their ailing title hopes alive as they go up against Sunderland. And at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree, Jason Corcoran writes on Dmitry Medvedev's lackluster first year as Russian president. And staying with Russia, times are hard for Russians as the global economic downturn bites. Some 6 million Russians are now unemployed, and the ruble has devalued by almost 20%. Add to that shares that have dropped sharply against a background of collapsing oil export prices, and the rising living standards Russians were getting used to in the Putin era no longer seem such a certainty. And the latest advice from the government recommends some pretty traditional remedies, as we now hear from our Moscow correspondent Luke Harding.
Russia's health ministry has come up with a novel scheme to persuade Russians to eat more healthily. And it seems to have sort of jumped on the economic crisis and said, look, now is the time for you know, Russians who tend to like rather fatty food to change their dietary habits. Now, I have to say, I've been looking at their website to see what they're suggesting, and it's pretty bland fare. It's things like oat porridge for breakfast and sort of cabbage and cauliflower salad, a lot of fish. Herring is very good, apparently. And bedtime snack is a glass of healthy yogurt and a slice of bread. I mean, there's no pizza. And I have to say, there's none of the food like blinis, pancakes and pelmeni that most of my Russian friends seem to eat.
So how do you think Russians will react to this?
Well, I suspect that they will probably ignore it. I mean, it's true that Russians are poorer. They're trying to economize. There's been a huge increase in food prices here, 17% on last year. And a lot of stuff here is imported. We have to see. Russian food is very kind of wholesome and very tasty. But I have to say, from my personal experience, you do slightly grow tired of it. And the idea of eating cabbage salad and oatmeal porridge every morning isn't really very appealing, but let's see.
So tell us a bit more about how the global economic downturn is affecting ordinary people in Russia.
It's been a huge story here. For the first 3 months or so, the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin, Russia's prime minister, blamed the whole crisis on America and said it was an American problem. Now, 6 months in, it's obvious that that's not true, that this has had a profound effect on Russia, on living standards here, on unemployment, which is, I think, now hitting about 7 million. The crisis is very, very serious. The ruble has been sinking dramatically. It's lost more than 30% of its value since last autumn. And I think, interestingly, it's also exacerbated political tensions between Vladimir Putin, who's the prime minister and is supposed to be the second person in government, and Dmitry Medvedev, who in theory, as Russia's president, is supposed to have the final say on everything. But I think no one is under any illusions here that Putin is still very much running the country, which, of course, for Medvedev is something of a humiliation.
So what's Medvedev himself been saying about the recession and how the country can weather the storm?
Well, Medvedev has been calling for reform. He's said that the government needs to do better. He's talked about kind of liberal economics. But the problem is that his power base appears to be dwindling. What we're seeing at the moment is a kind of war between rival Kremlin clans, if you like. And really, in this game of Russian politics, there's only one winner. And that, of course, is Mr. Putin. The interesting question is, you know, has Medvedev got it in him to rebel against Putin? Theoretically, he can sack Putin. I think the answer is no. I think genetically he's not capable of doing that. He's always been the junior partner. The two men have had a relationship going back to the early 90s when they were both worked in St. Petersburg's mayor's office. And although his position is a humiliating one, I don't see Medvedev turning. And I also think probably the relationship between the two of them is fundamentally good. It's fundamentally sound. But Medvedev has been doing some interesting things. For example, in January, after a human rights lawyer here and a journalist was shot dead on the streets of Moscow, Medvedev invited the editor of Novaya Gazeta, the kind of oppositionist newspaper, to go and see him. And that's something that would have been unthinkable, that Putin could never have done. And it's a sign to the Russian elite, if you like, that Medvedev, though he may be the number two, that he's still in the game.
And that was Luke Harding in Moscow. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Still to come in Guardian Daily, why it's something for nothing in a Chinese restaurant in Wiltshire.
Well, I think it's brilliant because the food is absolutely fabulous. We came here on Christmas Day and it was really, really good.
But first, Taliban leader Mullah Omar has called on members of the Pakistani Taliban to stop their activities inside Pakistan and join the struggle against coalition forces in Afghanistan. The request comes as the United States prepares to send an extra 17,000 troops to Afghanistan, and at a time of year when violence in Afghanistan usually increases as snow begins to melt. I asked Saeed Shah, who is in Islamabad for The Guardian, for more on Mullah Omar's request.
Well, there's two things. I think firstly, he's rather concerned that the Pakistani Taliban is killing more or less indiscriminately within Pakistan and it's bringing a very bad name to the Taliban movement, because they are killing fellow Muslims, innocent Pakistanis, as well as soldiers and policemen. But he believes that it is damaging the Taliban brand, if you like. The bigger concern, I think, for him is that the U.S. is about to throw thousands more soldiers into the Afghanistan campaign. This is part of Barack Obama's new strategy for Afghanistan. And I think he's hoping to give them a bloody nose. And the efforts of the new soldiers will be directed to areas close to the Pakistani border. So that's really why he wants the Pakistani Taliban to stop fighting within Pakistan and to join him in fighting in Afghanistan, in that, you know, just across the border in Afghanistan.
And what sort of numbers are we talking about? What kind of impact will they make on the struggle in Afghanistan?
Well, numbers is always difficult, you know, because this is a sort of guerrilla movement. But, you know, people be surprised at how few Afghan Taliban that there appear to be on a lot of estimates, you know, maybe 15,000 of them out there, you know. So Pakistani Taliban, you know, could number, say, 10, 15,000 themselves. I mean, I'm not saying they're all going to go rushing across to Afghanistan, but this could have a significant impact, I believe, if a lot of them did decide to focus on Afghanistan now. And as a guerrilla movement, you know, it's not really numbers, it's tactics, because they use suicide bombings, they use IEDs, and it's not really a numbers game, because it's, you know, they're sort of engaged in this, what they call asymmetric warfare.
Does that mean then that traditionally the spring is thought of as a time, the spring in Afghanistan is thought of as a time when fighting increases, but with these new methods of attacking foreign troops in particular, does that really make any difference?
Well, it's you know, the spring is really just because, you know, it's too snowy and cold in the winter, really, to engage in this sort of fighting. And even now, it may be March, but it won't really be till late April, till the fighting season really begins in Afghanistan. So it seems that these new Pakistani Taliban will be reorientated in time for the kind of spring offensive this year. So, you know, it could have an impact.
And are there any ideological differences between the Pakistani Taliban and the Afghan Taliban?
The difference really seems to be that there's a warlord called Baitullah Massoud, who's really been spearheading the Taliban offensive within Pakistan, and he seems to have come very heavily under the influence of Al Qaeda and this Bin Laden's ideology that says that a lot of people who say they are Muslims are not really Muslims, and it's fair enough to kill them. You know, and this is, even within the Taliban movement, this is a sort of controversial thought. So there is that ideological difference in that some of the Pakistani Taliban seem to be even more extreme than the Afghan Taliban. So there's that. But, you know, ultimately, you know, they are a very similar movement. The Pakistani Taliban, is a copycat movement of the Afghan Taliban. And they do ultimately recognize Mullah Omar as their leader.
Saeed Shah in Islamabad. Now, children who spend a lot of time in front of the television are at increased risk of developing asthma, a study has found. Researchers at Glasgow University looked at the medical records of some 14,000 children and found that those who watched more than 2 hours a day of TV at an early age had twice the risk of developing asthma later on. Our science correspondent Ian Sample explains the connection between television and asthma.
Well, it's nothing to do with the television programmes themselves or actually the act of watching television. What these scientists did was they used TV watching among young children as a proxy for inactivity. So it's an indicator of how sedentary your lifestyle is. And it really builds on a lot of work that's coming out now that's suggesting that the less active you are as a child, the greater your risk of developing asthma when you're at secondary school age and perhaps a little bit before that.
And why is that? What is it about watching or sitting still in front of a computer or TV or anything when you're young that leads to asthma later on?
This is really still an unknown. There are definitely indications that this is the case. And in the sort of literature, there's more speculation than anything more concrete than that. For example, one of the ideas is that if you're sedentary, then your breathing patterns change slightly, especially if you're a child, and that may have an effect on your future development. So some of the scientists think that if you're having regular exercise, then you're breathing deeply and regularly while you're doing that. They think that might help stretch the airways, and that might sort of make them less prone to asthma. But these are really just ideas at the moment.
So it sounds as if, I mean, the children in the study, it was said that those who watched more than 2 hours of television a day were more prone to asthma. But it seems likely then that if you watch 2 hours of television a day, but you also did lots of physical exercise, you might actually be fine.
That's right. I mean, in this study, the reason they used TV as a proxy was that when the study was done, there weren't really other ways of measuring physical activity. And when I say when the work was done, this is a huge database of medical records which has followed children basically through the 90s from the year zero to 11 and a half. And this study really looked at children who are healthy at 3.5 years old. What was their chance of having asthma by 11 and a half? And on average, that'll be 6%. But of the children who watched more than 2 hours of television a day, they were twice as likely to have asthma. So there seems to be a link, and it's if you watch a lot of TV, then you're probably going to be more inactive. And that seems to be the link that the scientists are drawing.
And how big or how important is this particular study, and how will it feed into all the information that's being gathered about children and the amount of damage that's being done to their health by watching too much TV and playing too much computer games and all of these things that seem to be going on in the modern world?
Well, it's interesting because the study seems to be pointing to, you know, the good things you should be doing and encouraging your children to do are those things that we've known for a long time. Get them out and get them doing exercise. And across the board, for all manner of conditions, that is the same advice. And this seems to point in the same direction. It's a big study. I mean, it's called the Avon Longitudinal Study, and it involves about 13,000 children, thousands of them anyway. So the statistical power, if you like, how good the study is pretty reliable. But as I say, the advice really that doctors come out with is what you would get from doctors anyway, is make sure your children are active.
Ian Sample there. One of the positive aspects of a recession, perhaps the only one, is the striking offers that abound in shops and restaurants. 70% off here, 2 for the price of 1 there. But few offers are as tempting as that being made by the Oriental Aroma restaurant in the Wiltshire town of Wootton Bassett. Eat all you want for free, and on your way out the door, collect a small token of the owner's gratitude to you for dining there. Our reporter Stephen Morris went there to find out how this is possible.
James Huynh, and I'm the owner of Oriental Roma.
So I've got my token now from the local paper. How's this going
to
work?
The idea is as a token of thank you to my previous customers, my loyal customers, in time before the recession, giving them the chance, those who actually been laid off work, and those who have money but worried, you know, wanting to make their pennies stretch a bit further. I thought, well, if I open up on a Sunday when I'm least busy, they would appreciate it. How it works is, on the first week, I offered everybody eat for free. The following week, I better it by offering it for free, plus I give them £1 for their trouble to come here. The condition is basically you spend a minimum of £5 on cold drinks.
Tell us what we've got here. What's here?
Chicken ball,
sesame balls,
onion ring,
onion bhaji, and vegetarian spinach, curry chenko. This for how special is chili pepper, five bean sprout, honey spearing, honey chicken wing, and chicken satay on skewer.
Okay. Well, I think it's brilliant because the food is absolutely fabulous. We came here on Christmas Day and it was really, really good.
Christmas Day? Chinese for Christmas Day?
To Christmas lunch on Christmas Day, yes. Perfect.
12.50, it was absolutely brilliant. It's lovely food.
Terrific variety. As much as you can eat is more than you can ask for, really. We've had shredded chicken, sweet and sour Hong Kong style, chow mein. We're just having some special Saigon chicken coming out in a minute to try. But we've come down again this weekend because my daughter's in the army. She's home this weekend, so we thought we'd bring her down because we're enjoying ourselves.
Business is thriving. The people that comes today, in the evening, through this week, next week, the following week, they will come back in the evening and spend.
And so today I'm going to get a meal, all I can eat, and then I'm going to get a pound as I walk out and a free beer as I walk out.
And a free beer to take home and enjoy.
And you've got the police coming in a bit to keep this queue in order?
I called the police just to supervise the high street because obviously, as you can see, there is a long queue. A lot of people probably think I'm crazy, but I can assure them I'm not.
Stephen Morris there with the restaurant owner who's putting smiles on diners' faces. And that's it from Guardian Daily today. The producers were Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Thank you for listening.